Okay.
There we go. That'll pick you up fine from there, I'm sure.
Good.
Where are you headed next from here? Yeah, we are rolling.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know.
Let me explain that the program is a 90-second daily rock and roll news program. So I edit comments from the interview. Is that door closed, Clive?
Yes, it is.
Great. Okay. Where is the tour going from here? How much longer will you be up there?
Well, we're about 10 days into a tour now. It lasts about 5.5 weeks.
And what do you expect you'll be doing after that?
I shall be returning to England, playing a couple of concerts at the Albert Hall. We probably will be going into the studio over the sort of Christmas, New Year's period for a few days just to develop some new ideas and some new directions towards making another album.
I wonder if you could give a little of the history of the evolution of the new members of the new band, actually.
Well, the new band is a band that was really formed out of an album recorded, the current new album A, which was really a solo Ian Anderson album made following the putting into a state of suspension the activities of Jethro Tull after our last European tour in April of this year, after which all the members of the current or the then group were going to make various sort of exploratory moves musically and domestically in terms of pursuing their own ideas, and I was going to do a solo album. That was my sort of project, as it were. So I brought in some other musicians to work with me on that, and out of that came an album which I was pressured, I think is probably the right word, to release as a Jethro Tull album, which, you know, that advice I accepted at the time, and we released it as a Tull album as opposed to an Ian Anderson album, and then obviously the invitations to come out and tour to support that album came in, and so here we are doing a tour with a group which is called Jethro Tull but has sort of 2.5 new members. I say 2.5 because the bass player in the new group was the bass player in the most recently known Jethro Tull lineup, although he'd only just joined. Yeah.
Do you have pretty much the same people on the tour as from the album?
It's exactly the same group. Yes, he is. Yes, playing the violin, keyboards. Young Eddie. He's a sort of temporary guest. He has his own. Well, I picked him up sort of in between his playing with a group called UK and his beginning of his own sort of solo career, forming a group of his own. And he has joined, as it were, as a guest with Jethro Tull for, you know, a couple of tours. And will be, you know, moving on to do his own musical activities.
How does he pronounce his name?
His real name is Edwin Jobson.
Jobson.
Not Jobson, Jobson.
Yeah, I've heard several different variations. How is your eye? Have there been any problems from the accident last year?
Yeah, I have recurring eye problems, actually, with the cellular growth on the front of the cornea over the wound keeps breaking down periodically every month or so. It sort of goes bad again, and you know, I get 2 or 3 nights of quite bad eye pain. But I actually saw the eye surgeon who attended me in Providence when we were back there just a few days ago, and he assured me that it was looking okay, and that it would gradually, these relapses would lessen in their frequency and their severity. So hopefully I will have a normal pair of eyes again one day. Something to look forward to.
Really? There was another incident just last week. I don't know if you heard the Black Sabbath concert, somewhat of a riot.
Mm.
Where one of the members got hit by a beer bottle and they walked off stage and refused to come back on. And just there were hundreds of people who were received minor injuries from the trash that was being thrown around the audience. And it's really good. Do you ever feel any kind of... do you ever, catch yourself and take a step backwards when you're on stage since that happened, in any kind of fear, or do you ever think about that while you're performing?
Well, I've been aware of that since I first started performing in arenas. It's been a constant dodging of occasional missiles. I remember when I first started doing these sort of stadium gigs that I learned with some horror that Mick Jagger, you know, played his entire set with the Rolling Stones sort of dodging sort of pennies and bottles and all the other stuff that was thrown at him from the audience. I mean, even my next door neighbour, a burly farmer in the south of England, admits to having been to a Rolling Stones concert when he was a bit younger and having thrown a ham sandwich at Mick Jagger, of which he's rather proud. I mean, I don't mind ham sandwiches, but obviously when it gets to things like bottles or, you know, heavy objects, they can be terribly dangerous. So I was aware that it happened, and it was, you know, with even more horror that I realised that it did happen to us too. There are a few crazies out there every night who seem to get their thrills from acts of aggression.
There was that scene in Blues Brothers, maybe I don't know if you saw it, where they performed in one club. It was supposed to be just a backwards country band type place, and they had a cyclone fence up in front of the stage. And the band was actually locked up in this fence to protect them from things that were thrown at them. It was really an incredible scene.
Yeah, well, we've always, you know, considered the various things we might do to lessen it. I mean, my own reaction to the phenomenon has been to do a series of radio pronouncements along the lines of, you know...
Excuse me, I wonder if this is...
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Is there some way to use a plug right here on the floor? I'll take care of that. Okay, we're rolling for radio interviews.
My own reaction to this particular phenomenon has been... My own reaction to this particular phenomenon has been to do a series of radio pronouncements, both condemning the throwing of objects and also to point out to people that their and my best form of security is to be prepared to shop, as we say in England, to tell on, to identify within the crowd anyone they see performing any malicious act of that sort. There are quite a lot of security people and indeed policemen at every concert, and I mean, I always say to people, if you see the guy next to you lifting something up to throw it at the stage or into the audience, you know, don't sit around, wait for him to do it again. You know, just go and tell somebody who's in authority, that's the guy, have him out, because he will be removed very, very speedily. And the audience are their own best security. You know, I've personally had a lawsuit against me and the group for some little girl who suffered the loss of sight in one eye through a firecracker, having been thrown, whether at me or into the audience or whatever. But I mean, I've seen other people with their hair on fire at concerts, you know, from fireworks and so on. It's extremely annoying and potentially very, very dangerous, and a lot of people get injured every year at rock concerts, and it's really so absurd. It is rapidly... It's not getting any worse, thank goodness. In fact, the tendency is that it's getting better, simply because people who do throw things are no longer safe. Nowadays, you know, the folks around them are starting to do something about it. So it is beginning to work, you know. You're not safe if you throw anything in a rock concert anymore, because the guy next to you, even if he's not bigger than you, is going to make sure that you're going into some kind of trouble. But it did deteriorate, you know, I think, in the post-hippie era, you know, when everybody was sufficiently down on sort of mind-reducing drugs to just really be a little bit too sleepy to do anything of that sort. Now alcohol seems to have come much to the fore again, especially there are a lot of no-smoking signs in the concerts we play. And the level of violence and aggression was producing something akin to the British football match crowd, you know, which has a tremendous reputation for violence. Unlike, incidentally, most American sports where, you know, the whole family go out to see a baseball match. Well, in England, I mean, you know, you don't. I mean, it's just too dangerous. The football crowds now in England, it's extremely dangerous.
I understand. It was recently
very violent.
An international football match in Europe where they actually allow only like 60 people, just the team and their immediate family and friends, and that was it.
Well, they are now preventing at many football matches any of, for instance, any Scottish football supporters to go, because they have such a reputation for violence. Many English supporters are banned from many clubs in Europe in international matches. And, I mean, it really is disgusting. It unfortunately is dragging down football to the point where the game has now suffered so tremendously. And the same thing could very easily happen to rock concerts. There is legislation afoot in this country, at least in one state that I know about, to clamp down very heavy security measures on rock concerts. And that's not good for the audience, it's not good for the musicians, and it's not good for music.
Not the right atmosphere at all.
Unfortunately not, but it's proving necessary.
Let's get back to music and records. I'm getting some comments for a program I'll be producing later in the year, probably into the new year, on producers. Now this is co-produced, the new album is co-produced with Robin Black. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Robin Black and how it was to work with him.
Well, Robin Black was the tape operator, as you call them over here. You give them the lofty title of second engineer. On our second album, I think, and he was a sort of second engineer, if you like, on a couple of records after that, and there came a point when we were changing from working at the studio we usually worked at to working in a different studio, and we asked Robin to come and engineer one of our albums as a proper engineer, and which he did. So he became really the group's favorite, or well, the guy who engineered all our records, basically. He was an easy person to work with, you know. And from that point on, he became involved in the studio business that we set up in England, managing that. And he's still my studio manager in England. And he still engineers Jethro Tull albums and is a co-producer in the sense that he, like all the members of the group and myself, is a sort of, you know, a corporate thing to arrive at the end product.
Did you pretty well maintain overriding control on the final sound of the music as it comes out on the record?
If there was something I wasn't happy with, then I would, you know, obviously voice those sentiments. But by and large, you know, I hope that the way we work is, you know, without really too much disagreement going on. I'm sure there are probably better ways to produce a record that it might be startlingly more or emphatically more produced, you know, but on the other hand, we do have a workable relationship, and it is quite a healthy one to have someone that you don't have to keep talking to all the time. He knows the way you like the drums to sound, he knows the way the guitarist wants his guitar to sound, and, you know, you just work a lot more efficiently that way.
I saw a clipping about a year ago where you had worked on writing material for ballet, Underground Rooms, with John Anderson and several other people.
Mm.
Was that just performed really only once, or is that being performed anywhere, or are there any plans for the future with that?
It's not being performed currently. It was performed as part of a tour in Scotland and later around England, and at Drury Lane Theatre in London by the Scottish Ballet, who asked us, you know, to write these things. It's a part of their repertoire, should they care to use it. Indeed, they were supposed to have been doing an American tour now, and I know my brother, who runs the Scottish Ballet, was, you know, hopeful that they were going to include that as part of the programme. But unfortunately, through economic considerations, the backers who were bringing the ballet over got cold feet, and the money wasn't forthcoming, so the tour was cancelled. So whether or not that particular piece of music or the ballet will ever be seen or heard in this country is, I would say, you know, doubtful, to say the least.
Who else was involved in that besides you and John Anderson?
Well, John Anderson wrote his own piece. David Palmer and Martin Barr and myself wrote our piece, you know, as a sort of Jethro Tull contribution. And the other piece of music in the set was a piece by Duke Ellington. But there were three choreographers, and if you like, three sets of authors of the music, and three separate ballets, supposedly with an umbrella, a common theme. But I wouldn't have said artistically it was a resounding triumph. You know, there were a lot of weak things about it, just due to the fact that you did have three separate sets of authors, you know, both dance and music, trying to do something that didn't really tie together.
Was that the first time that you wrote for dancing?
No, not actually. I did actually write a piece of music once for a troupe of dancers called Pan's People, who are sort of rock dancers who fill in on a TV program that's been running for years and years in Britain called Top of the Pops. I wrote a piece of music once for them as a dance piece, which they actually performed somewhere. I can't remember where they did it. Probably one of our concerts, they opened the show. But other than that, no. But I have written for orchestra before, quite a lot of stuff that was demo music when we were putting together a synopsis for a movie, and a lot of orchestral music recorded for that.
Do you have any plans for video or film in the future, or just in the future?
I think the possibility of video grows ever nearer, but at an alarmingly slow rate. I was very interested in the prospect of a video revolution in terms of people's entertainment as long ago as 1974, when the development of the hardware between Philips, who were working on in Europe, and MCA, who had a lot of catalogue material that they'd been storing up when they did a deal. Unfortunately, there's been rather a slow movement in terms of the hardware side of it, and so far, other than test batches of playing units for video disc, for floppy video discs having gone out, there's been, you know, a very, 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 very slow movement towards video, and videotape is just simply too expensive. The rental of videotapes in a library sense is a realistic sales situation now, but I doubt whether there is sufficient volume of rental in terms of cassettes to justify the enormous outgoings. If someone's made a movie already and it's recouped for the investors and it's into profit, then after a number of years you can say, okay, let's do a video rental on it, you know, and pick up a few extra cents, you know. But if you're looking at a rock concert, if you like, on video, or a video album as such, you're looking at production costs of something, you know, like around $500,000 to do it in the sort of, to the sort of standards that it must be done, because it is done. I mean, there is some very, very good promotional video stuff being done in England, much higher quality than anything I've seen over here. And it's very expensive to make, very expensive in editing time. So you would come in on an album somewhere around $500,000 to do it, you know, up to a standard where it would really stand comparison with the best of what's been done already. You can obviously do it very cheaply if you want to, but it's going to look very cheap. It's going to look like Don Kirshner's rock concert used to look like before they started using people's very expensive promo video films. I watched it last night, for example, and it was great to watch some really prime, well-made television in a Paul McCartney promo film. You know, very good piece of video. Very corny, but beautifully put together, and, you know, illustrated his music and his approach admirably. It was great. But there's no way under the sun that a television program like Rock Concert or anything in England could afford to make a video film like that, because the cost of that must have been somewhere in the region of $30,000. And that's just too high a budget for a one-off, you know, act.
For a few other future programs, what plans, if any, do you have, or what do you expect to be doing in 1981?
I don't know. We were talking about that just downstairs before I came up, and the answer is I don't know. Otherwise, I'd tell you. Actually, I probably wouldn't, but I still don't know. You know, we're just literally just getting down to talking about it now, because we're sort of getting now into the back part of 1980, and we have to make plans usually about 6, 8, 9 months ahead, because of the difficulty in securing venues that we play a concert tour and scheduling album releases and so on. So it is getting to the time where we have to make that decision, but it hasn't actually been made yet.
A little bit of speculation further in the future. What do you see for Ian Anderson and or Jethro Tull in, say, 1985? Where do you think he'll be? What do you think he'll be doing?
Well, I know that I will, you know, if there is a market for musical product, I mean, assuming the bomb hasn't dropped or the world hasn't turned over in some fashion, then, you know, I shall be, I hope, still practicing music, and hopefully, you know, still selling records or doing concerts or whatever. I mean, I would hope that Jethro Tull remains a buoyant commodity, you know, in the ongoing future. But it would be wrong of me to say that I was satisfied being a musician and nothing else in life. I do have other spare time pursuits which are important to me on a personal level and may well be important to me on an economic level too. I have considerable investments of both money and time in land in terms of conservation and farming and some more experimental forms of farming. I'm farming salmon up in the west coast of Scotland, these sort of things. Hello, as the rumble goes on in the background. This is live radio, folks. This is what happens. You know.
Last thing. Again, for my files. Hopefully they'll be done. What is, if you don't mind, your birth date? And either what would you like to be doing on your next birthday, or what kind of things impress you in a gift, or what was the gift you received once that really just floored you?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's a bit like what colour underpants do you wear, but in this case I don't mind answering it because I can remember my last birthday vividly, if only because someone said, how old are you? And I honestly didn't know, which is the first time I wasn't really sure. That's how old I am. So, no, it's interesting because actually people often say to me, you know, what's your sign, man, or whatever. And I've been so used to that over the years as a sort of post-hippie kind of obvious question from well-wishers. They say, what sign are you? And I always ask them to guess, and the absurd thing is that about 95% of them guess right, you see. So I mean, if you out there in Radioland would like to just give that a moment's thought, just what sort of a, you know, what do you see me as, you see? You're right, you got it straight away. Of course I'm a Leo. 10th of August I was born on, yeah. But they all guess it. It's amazing.
What, is there any particular gift that you really remember?
Well, yes, and my last birthday, actually, I actually spent on my own in our Scottish house because my wife was down in England because we had a horse that was racing. She's very fond of horses and has a couple of horses, and she had to be down there because this horse was racing, which eventually didn't do because it was lame. But she was down there with the children, and I was actually spent my birthday completely on my own. And I tell a lie, I think my son was with me. But anyway, when I eventually did have my birthday, which was delayed by sort of a week or so, when we were all together again, she gave me a fishing rod, which probably sounds like a pretty boring birthday present, but I'd never fished, you see, since I was very small, and I decided to take up game fishing, you see. I mean, fishing for trout and salmon, and always been a bit sceptical about whether I would enjoy it, because it seemed rather a slow and a sort of dogmatic kind of sport, you see. I enjoy outdoor sports, but, you know, fishing just seemed a little bit slow-paced. But in fact, I really did enjoy fishing and began quite a serious study of it, and it's become quite a... Well, something I'm really looking forward to doing next year is getting my fishing rod out again as soon as the season starts and going down to the bottom of the garden and... you know, into one of the deep pools and having a go at those old trout again. Yes, most enjoyable.
You have a salmon. Yes, I'm done at this point. You have salmon. You're raising salmon on your estate now, or?
Yes, we are. We actually grow salmon, you know, to a market weight of about 8 pounds. And this is our first. We've been experimenting for 2 years, you know, testing water conditions with an experimental batch, which has proved very successful, and we now have our first commercial stocking, which will produce 50 tons of 2-year-old salmon in the spring of 1982. So, I mean, we should be up to about 75, 80 tons by 83, but we're also looking now to start another 2 or 3 salmon farms and a hatchery and processing plant as well. So we're sort of moving into the fish. Well, I say we because although the first salmon farm is mine, the future expanding thing is actually a core. I'm involved in. I go to business meetings, you know, with a briefcase, and it's rather fun. I actually enjoy doing that. Actually, I can. I don't wear a suit. I mean, I just go as I am. But I actually get to carry a briefcase and talk to people who, you know, run merchant banks and things. And it's quite amusing. They don't know whether to take me seriously, and I know certainly not to take them seriously. So we have a great time.